TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Julia Witte, For Love and Protection of the Deep Ocean.
How does the entertainment industry form our understanding of people and events? In the fall of 2016, the movie Deepwater Horizon grossed $65 million worldwide in the first few weeks. The film contains heroic action, fire, and explosions on that drilling rig in the Gulf of Mexico. The only animals harmed are two prehistoric-looking birds colliding with windshields. No mention of the impact of at least 210 million gallons of oil spilled into the ocean and onto the coastline, the toxic dispersant used in that summer of 2010, and the persisting harm caused under the surface of the sea in the deep ocean. Julia Witte is environmental correspondent for Mother Jones and reported on a diving investigation right after the Deepwater Horizon exploded. I met her at a book release party soon after her return and asked her a few questions after her reading. Here's a rebroadcast of the program I produced.
I met Julia Witte in August 2010, immediately after Carol Browner, the White House energy and climate advisor, had claimed that the vast majority of oil that had poured into the Gulf of Mexico for almost 3.5 months had already disappeared. In a small Northern California town where she lives, Julia Witte was giving a reading from her new book, Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. The book had been described as breathtakingly learned and lyrical, written with humor, reverence, and curiosity. Julia Witte is a diver, former nature documentary filmmaker, author, and investigative journalist. As environmental correspondent for Mother Jones, she had just returned from the Gulf Coast. She wrote, BP and its partners' reckless quest has endangered and perhaps condemned not just the Gulf Coast, but the largest, richest, most pristine, most biologically important, and last completely unprotected ecosystem left on Earth, the deep ocean. On that night in early August, Julia Witte explained why the deep ocean is the foundation of life for the upper layer of the sunlit sea. Many whales, dolphins, seals, sea turtles, sharks, and smaller predatory fish are nocturnal hunters, dependent on the movements of a vast community of organisms that live in the deep ocean. That community is known only since the 1920s as the deep scattering layer. And this deep scattering layer that rises and falls with day and night, and that is visited by the creatures of the sunlit sea, is threatened by the invisible part of the gigantic outpour of oil that never came to the surface because it was hit by chemical dispersants, and now doubly invisible by the White House claim that 75% has already disappeared. But researchers and divers report on huge clouds of dispersed oil and of dissolved natural gas and methane that remain below the surface and now move around the Gulf. These toxic clouds are separating the creatures of the deep ocean from those in the twilight and sunlit zones. And wherever the clouds of oil and gas move in, the creatures from above and below have to travel through the poisonous brew twice in one day to survive. I begin this program with a reading by Julia Witte from Deep Blue Home, followed by her comments on the BP oil spill. The reading is introducing the deep scattering layer in an indirect way. A whale is sinking to the bottom of the sea, and that journey from sun to twilight, to perpetual darkness, introduces you to the creatures of another world. Julia Whitty.
Countless millions of whales once churned the sunlit waters of the world, some scouring the seafloor for buried mollusks, some chasing capelin up from the deep, some corralling krill, some wrestling giant squid. Yet these cumulative actions of their daily lives in no way marked the sum of their services in the world, which persisted far beyond the span of their own existence into the fetch of the future. Like old growth trees that fall and die and spend centuries nourishing a forest with the fruits of their rot, so the great whales sink to the bottom of the sea to nourish the oceans with their decay. A great whale's death journey to the bottom of the sea is accelerated or braked by the presence or absence of fat in its body. Lean, starved whales fall faster than fatter whales. Regardless, the downward journey takes place in the slow motion of the underwater world as the processes of decomposition produce buoyant gases that duel with the force of gravity in such a way that the carcass rides a gentle elevator up and down on its way down. A sperm whale off the Galapagos, a gray whale in the Gulf of California, a humpback off Newfoundland, all become part of the windfall that descends from the surface to the collapsed depths of the abyss. The first visitors to arrive at the deathbed of most whales are the swimmers of the pelagic ocean, the torpedo-like mako sharks, blue sharks, silky sharks, tuna, and billfish, who tear at the carcasses, opening it for the big fish with small mouths, and for the smaller fish with big mouths, and for all the tiny planktonic predators who will join the dead whale on the elevator ride up and down. Later, the bulkier scavengers, tigers, and great white sharks will work their way across scores or even hundreds of miles of ocean to join the whale's vertical migration. In the ink-black waters below 600 feet, the mesopelagic community begins to attach itself to the carcass of a great whale, the barracudinas, the cross-toothed perches, the myriad of squid, the lanternfish, and lancetfish. When a falling whale enters their world, a world the whale might well have fed upon her entire life, those who were her prey gathered to feast upon her remains. Many of these dwellers of the middle sea possess extraordinarily large eyes and a series of light-producing organs known as photophores. Hidden within perpetual darkness, these fish produce weak blue, green, or yellow lights whose colors and patterns reveal the individual species and gender, as well as information shared for the purpose of shoaling and other communications we can't understand. The photophores, controlled by internal dimmer switches, also create a camouflage known as counter-illumination, so that those dining on the falling whale are as good as invisible against the faint glow from above. Pushed and prodded by a ravening army of razor blades and cutlasses, the whale slips into the bathypelagic zone below 3,000 feet. Here, the pressures of the depths are greater than 100 times those at the surface, squeezing the buoyant decomposition gases from the tissues of the whale once and for all, so that now her inexorable path is downward only. The carcass begins to fold and even break at the weak joints, the first stages of the flattening of the deep. New fish appear, animals missing parts seemingly vital to existence in our world, such as hearts, brains, kidneys, muscles, scales, eyes, gills, skeletons. Some of these dwellers of the profound sea are endowed with the ability to eat three times their body weight, stuffing whale meat into distensible stomachs until their bellies dwarf their bodies, as if upside down hot air balloons were dangling below the tiny gondolas of their backs and fins. Some, like gulper eels, become little more than floating jaws with cellophane bags for bodies, a plan designed to maximize the one and only meal that may come their way in a year. Odd gelatinous anglerfish approach, the females casting with the fishing tackle attached to their foreheads, complete with rods, lines, luminescent lures, and sometimes hooks. Their male partners take the form of tiny parasitical appendages attached by their jaws to the female skin, where they subsist on embryo-like connections to her blood supply. Thus conjoined, the males atrophy to nothing more than gonads, awaiting the moment to spawn. Finally, hours or even days after death, the whale finds the soft bottom of the sea and settles into the muck, where it becomes an island for the migrations of sleeper sharks, king crabs, and hagfish. These scavengers are joined over time by the slower-moving migrant feeders of the abyss, sea cucumbers, sea stars, brittle stars, burrowing urchins, and worms, who caravan between the feeding stations of large things fallen from the surface, the big whales, big fish, big tree trunks, and huge mats of kelp and other vegetation blown offshore by storms. On the vast desert of the ocean floor, a whale fall is an unexpected oasis, literally dropping out of the blue and providing a nutritional bonanza of a magnitude that might otherwise take thousands of years to accumulate from the background flow of small detritus from the surface. A 35-ton gray whale takes 1.5 years to be stripped to the bone by the scalpels and stomachs of the deep. A 160-ton blue whale might take as many as 11 years. Yet even beyond that, even after a dead whale's organic matter appears to have been completely devoured, the blubber-saturated sediments surrounding the bone support dense populations of chemosynthesizing bacteria and microbes. When nothing is left but the skeleton, the bones themselves become fuel for a preternatural whalefall community, including osedaks, or bone-eating worms, which consist mostly of roots that bore into the skeleton to extract its proteins. Bone-eating worms are aided in their work by symbiotic single-celled bacteria able to fuel themselves on the organic carbon of the dead whale. Thanks to these bacteria, osedaks survive without any gut whatsoever. And they are only one example among the strange wonders of abyssal oases, where much of the primary production is done by chemoautotrophic organisms that make life from non-life using chemistry, not sunlight. In a world without eyes, unseen by any living thing, the dead whale becomes a shadow atop the shadow of the bottom of the world, living in its afterdeath for another 100 years, maybe more.
That was Julia Whitty reading from her new book, Deep Blue Home. I asked her about the breaking news of the day that the White House had announced that the well was capped and most of the oil had already disappeared.
They're trying to spin it right now that, hey, it's all done.
Yeah.
You know, hey, look, it's mostly gone. It's all been weathered. And we've been lied to about this thing more or less from the beginning. You know, the reality is, I talked about those the fish that have the light organs, the photophores that they signal with. And they are the dominant fish in a community that lives in the ocean. It's the largest biomass of life on Earth. It's known as the deep scattering layer. And it's a huge aggregation of life forms that lives below the cusp of perpetual darkness in the ocean, which means during the daytime, they're down below light, usually below 1,000 feet. And they rise with sunset, and they rise with night, just below the edge of night, until by nightfall, they are up at the surface. And virtually everything we know of the sunlit sea, the whales, the dolphins, most of the fish we eat or catch, you know, the seabirds, the turtles, the sharks, the billfish, the predatory fish, most of them make their living hunting the deep scattering layer. Virtually all of them are nocturnal hunters that wait for this great dumb waiter of sea flute to rise from the deep every night, and they either dive down to meet it. Some of them even specialize on diving down and catching it in the day, making extremely deep dives. Because down in the cold water at those depths of 3,000 or so feet, a lot of these creatures of the deep scattering layer, which are fish and squid and all kinds of zooplankton, a lot of them enter a state akin to sleep. It's almost like a little mini hibernation that goes on. They become torpid in the cold, slows their metabolism down, and they get to use less energy. And actually, ecologists have worked out that it makes more sense for many of these animals to swim the human equivalent of 25 miles up to the surface, feed all night in productive surface waters that are fueled by the plant plankton, the phytoplankton that are fueled by sunlight, and then swim the human equivalent of 25 miles back down into the deep and spend the day in the cold, barely running, shut down kind of like little yogis down there. You know, they've got everything shut way down. And it's more effective for them to do that. That was a long-winded way of getting to the problem that I see, the biggest problem in the Gulf of Mexico with what has happened. is the fact that from the very beginning, BP was hitting that wellhead at 5,000 feet deep with chemical dispersants. And the problem is they took what was a source point of pollution of a buoyant pollutant, namely oil, that would really have risen to the surface where it could have been skimmed or scooped, right? And what they did was they hit it at the wellhead, they dispersed it so effectively that it's now formed these vast underwater plumes that are in essence neutrally buoyant, may never ever rise to the surface, will never be collectible, can never be brought back in. And it's down there, and this huge foundational biomass of the ocean, the deep scattering layer, has to migrate through these plumes twice a day. Well, what does that tell you? And already some of the people who are looking at this are finding that these plumes are trapping the deep scattering layer. I mean, I've talked with researchers who've been diving out there, and researchers who've dived down in clear water, done their work on the bottom for 30 minutes, and on their way up, they've encountered oil that moved in, a plume that moved in, and they've had to come up through oil. The deep scattering layer, these animals are going to be trapped beneath the plumes and unable to get up to the surface to feed, or they're going to have gotten up there and be trapped and unable to get back away from the predators of the day who are going to come out and get them. And it's also mixed with dispersant, which very well may be more toxic than either the oil or the dispersant alone. So it's a pretty dreadful situation, and you know, the bottom line as to why did BP hit the wellhead with all this dispersant, and the truth is they know, based on the Exxon Valdez reality, that their legal liability is going to depend on somewhere between $1,000 and about $4,500 per barrel of legal liability for oil spilled. And if they hit that oil at the wellhead, who's going to say how much oil ever came out of that thing? So it's a way of disguising the real truth of how much oil came out of that reservoir before they capped it. That's the only explanation, and it's essentially a criminal act, in my opinion. The problem is the Gulf of Mexico was already one of the most stressed out ocean ecosystems on Earth. Many endangered species barely holding on. We know that about 1,600 sperm whales live in the northern Gulf of Mexico, maybe never leave, that they feed on squid in the deep scattering layer. And they specifically feed in an area right in the Mississippi Canyon, right around the Deepwater Horizon wellhead. We know that critically endangered western bluefin tuna would have spawned in the Gulf right around the Deepwater Horizon wellhead at the time of the blowout. And we also know that the adults are very deep divers, and they dive down into the deep scattering layer in the daytime. They make dives of over 3,000 feet deep in search of critters of the deep scattering layer. Some of these species and some of these ecosystems may never recover from these assaults that have been launched as a result of this really reckless pirating of the deep. We don't even look at what we're doing down there. There's no environmental impact statement for the deep sea floor out there. And, you know, we just act like it doesn't matter. And I hope this will change that. The one positive that might come out of this is that we'll actually reconsider the ocean beyond our sight, the horizon far from shore, and the deep water column that really supports all the life of the ocean that we love so much. There's about 30,000 holes punched in the floor of the Gulf of Mexico. 27,000 of them are abandoned wells that are mostly not being monitored. You know, whether they've been sealed up properly, whether they're still leaking. Hurricane Katrina, when it came through, popping well heads off and knocking over containers and rupturing pipeline. There's 30,000 miles of pipeline underlying the Gulf of Mexico that's carrying all this oil and natural gas from these holes in the seafloor to shore. Hurricane Katrina actually caused an estimated 8 million gallons of oil spill, which is just slightly shy of the Exxon Valdez. And a recent study shows that, in fact, all this pipeline is extremely vulnerable to hurricane force waves down to about 300 feet. The waves have enough power to undermine the seafloor, causing seafloor collapses that could break the pipeline. So, you know, we have to really think about when we look at our future and when we look at the true costs of oil, the real cost of oil, how expensive cheap oil really, really is. And hopefully this, again, is something we'll take a look at as we move forward and make collective decisions about our future and what we want it to look like. I think the dispersed plumes of oil, which are neutrally buoyant and bobbing around in the water column, there isn't much we can do about those, really. Ideally, we would make it illegal to ever use chemical dispersants again and make that stick somehow. That would be issue number one. For the marshlands that lie at the mouth of the Mississippi River, the Louisiana marshlands, which was where most of the television coverage and most of the print media coverage was focused. And those marshlands are basically the womb of the Gulf of Mexico. It's the nursery ground for everything, all the fish and shellfish and oysters, and you name it, almost all of it happens in those marshlands. Those marshlands were under terrible threat before the oil spill, and they were losing something like a football field every 30 minutes. So the best thing we could do for that area, the womb of the ocean, to allow these larval, teeny little fish to go in and have their little babyhood in the protected nursery of the marshes, would be to open the floodgates of the Mississippi River. So if you look at Google Earth images or satellite images of the mouth of the Mississippi River, it doesn't look natural, and it isn't, because we've basically taken the river and we're driving it through canals that are shooting it very fast right past the marshlands out into the deep water. So this enables all the shipping of the Mississippi to come and go easily, and they don't have to worry about navigating, you know, shifting shoals and sandbars and all those treacherous things that lie at the mouths of big rivers. But it's been at the cost of these marshlands, which rely on the sediment. They rely on the decomposing landmass of North America that gets, you know, run downstream on the flowing waters to be deposited in the delta. This would help, first of all, remediate the problems of the oil spill, because the only thing that's going to really happen eventually is sediment is going to overlie the oil and just bury it into that geological layer. So those would be two important things. No more dispersant and open the floodgates of the Mississippi. Those would help remediate not only this problem, but a lot of other problems that have been plaguing the Gulf of Mexico. I don't like to fall to pessimism, because then you just quit. So I prefer to keep, you know, working and trying to think of ways, and I honestly believe that we have it in our power to change all of these things. We actually know the answers. It's not like we're sitting there scratching our heads going, God, what do we do about that? We know exactly what to do about all of these problems, and it really is a matter of collective will and, to a large extent, political will. And we have to remember that the only way we can turn the ship, however slowly and laboriously the ship is moving towards this dreadful future, I mean, it's only us that are at the helm. And, you know, we can crank that damn wheel over and reverse course. So, again, part of the reason I write about these things and I talk about these things is hoping to contribute to everyone's commitment to continuing to do whatever we all can do to make sure that these changes are made.
That was Julia Witte, author, diver, documentary filmmaker, and environmental correspondent for Mother Jones. I'm ending this program with another reading from her new book, Deep Blue Home. This is a report from one of her underwater filming expeditions.
We encounter the peculiar handiwork of modern hunters in drenching sleet on a desolate Newfoundland shoreline. The sky wafts among us, ghosts of icy mist that cling, pass through, and drape over, separating us from each other as if we've drifted into different universes. Some of these fingers are cold enough that we can hear the crackling of ice crystals tapping at our neoprene hoods. As quickly as we can, we lurch toward the water, stumbling not just from the cold and dark, but from the phantoms here. This small beach, composed of rocks and pebbles, is now obscured by bones. Thousands and thousands of rostra, scapulae, ribs, phalanges, vertebrae, crania, and mandibles, the remains of some of the 54,000 long-finned pilot whales killed in the Newfoundland dry fishery between 1947 and 1971. We struggle to walk on such uneven pavement, slick with ice and green with algae, and are grateful to flop forward at the water's edge, only to find the horror magnified underwater as our faceplates skim bare inches above the seafloor. The beach may be overflowing with disassembled skeletons, yet it's only a veneer compared to what lies beneath the waves. as if a cargo container holding all the bones of the world had broken apart offshore and washed up here. These last surviving pieces of the whales have been rolled by the waves, their edges tumbled and polished into homogeneity, the sea mixing and matching once separate animals, males with females, calves with adults, relatives with rivals. The water is 44 degrees, as cold as a cod's nose, according to Peter, who does not join us in its shocking embrace. The water is clear enough to award us an unhindered picture of the sloping seabed and its mountains of skeletons. We swim to the left and to the right and offshore and never find an end to the bones. It's a mausoleum of marble, utterly silent, except for the radio static of snapping shrimp, a eulogy broadcast from the past. Strange sentries abound among the bones, some so bone-like they appear to be bones, invisible at first and then unmistakable, squat, homely fish with horn-like spines around bulbous eyes, broad heads tapering to folded tails, backs prickly with spines. They are short-horned sculpins, whom the Newfoundlanders call horny whores. Their mouths are wide, down-set, thick-lipped, grumpy. Yet ugliness is part of the sculpin's superb design, allowing these fish to open their mouths wide enough to swallow anything and everything that wanders by. Crabs, capelin, sea stars, amphipods, marine worms, including prey nearly their own size. Stealth is their hook, followed by speed. When I swim too close, a sculpin grunts and jumps off its perch, pectoral fins folded tight to its body, and lands on a nearby bone. When I keep coming, it sashays resolutely away, undulating to the left and the right with each bat-like flap of its wings. It's a simple world, characteristic of the high latitudes, where species become fewer and ecosystems more concise. But it's also haunted by what used to be and no longer is, by the 60,000 long-finned pilot whales who once summered off Newfoundland.
That was an excerpt from Deep Blue Home, read by the author Julia Whitty. She is a diver, documentary filmmaker, and environmental correspondent for Mother Jones. I filmed her in August 2010 in the small Northern California town of Sebastopol, where she lives.
Come back when TUC Radio returns for stories on minke whales, icebergs, and a free-ranging conversation with Julia Whitty.
You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.